This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Korhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. The television version of this show airs on Free Speech TV every weekday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. FSTV is on Dish Network, DirecTV, and Roku. The U.S.-Mexico border is nearly 2,000 miles long and is one of the most politicized in the world, a crossing point for millions of people over the past decades. Donald Trump has made it a major part of his political platform to build an $8 billion wall between the two countries. But while there is serious economic inequality, people will continue to cross the border any way they can. My guest, Kimball Taylor, has written a book that reads like fiction about a creative enterprise to help migrants cross the border that involved thousands of bicycles and millions of dollars. Kimball Taylor is a longtime contributor to Surfer magazine. His earlier books include Return by Water, Surf Stories and Adventures, and Drive Fast and Take Chances, Fair Warning from Surfers. He now joins me to discuss his brand new book. It's called The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and a Borderland Empire. Welcome to the program, Kimball.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, honestly, when I first picked up your book, I did think it was fiction for a second. So because you write it in a very lyrical way as a story unfolding, but it is a true story. How is it that you came upon this sort of bizarre and also very interesting phenomenon? I think it's phenomenon is a good word to describe it, that it turns out thousands of migrants have been crossing the U.S. border on bicycle. I mean, we know of the crossings on foot, which are extremely treacherous, often end in death or assault. We know that crossings, by car or truck to parts of it, but bicycles is something I hadn't heard before. How did you come upon it?
Well, it all started with piles of abandoned bicycles that were left in the Tijuana River Valley, which is actually the American side of the border. I generally write about ocean issues, and I had an assignment to cover the event of thousands of car tires that were washing out of the Tijuana River from Mexico into the United States and eventually making their way to the ocean. Along that stretch on the American side, it's very rural. There's small farms, ranches, and I was talking to this horse rancher while he was picking up these car tires and throwing them into this 40-foot dumpster about the circularity of this issue of these tires returning to the United States. And he said, yeah, it's just like the bicycles. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, look right over here. And we walked around his barn. He had a giant pile of bicycles. He said he collected 1,000 bikes in the last 6 months. I said, where did they come from? And he pointed up the hill, because Tijuana is 300 feet higher than the American Valley below. And he said, they're coming from Mexico. Each little farm and ranch along that stretch in the state and county parks along there had piles of bicycles, and there's just something that happens to you, not only me, but many people, when you walk into these ownerless piles of bicycles, bikes for every stage of your life, you begin to wonder, where did they come from? Where are they going? How did they get here? The most incredible part of this aspect is where this rancher pointed up at the headlands of the Tijuana River Valley is the most fortified 5-mile stretch of our 2,000-mile border. Every technology you could bring to bear on the border is in place there, from infrared cameras to laser tripwires to seismic sensors to the walls and barriers themselves, as well as all the agents motoring through this landscape in trucks and jeeps and on quads. And the mystery of how these bicycles arrived in this valley and were abandoned just lit my curiosity.
So you wanted to then trace the origins, and you did indeed trace them. But as you write in your book, it's certainly not very easy. It's not as though you can simply type in a bicycle serial number and trace its path, from one owner to the other. Certainly these aren't even formal transactions. How was it that you came upon this person that you refer to as El Indio in your book, who started this enterprise, a very lucrative enterprise that made him, at least for time, quite fabulously wealthy? How did that, tell us that story of how you traced the bicycles to this enterprise.
Well, as you mentioned, bicycles become liquid at one stage. They're fungible, like a dollar is fungible. Once a bike leaves your hand, it joins this sea of bicycles, just as once a dollar leaves your hand, it joins the idea of the dollar. And even though both have serial numbers, no one ever keeps track. So they just, you know, they vanish into the economy. The only way that I could get this story was actually talking to the people who handed the bicycles one to the next. I did that in the United States for a while because the bikes moved out of the valley and into the country in really interesting and incredible ways. But I also realized that I had to go to Mexico and I had to find the people who, or, you know, I didn't know at that stage if it was organized or if it was just a trend, but I went to find out how people were crossing and what made it possible.
So tell us a little bit about what a journey might be for somebody who might have ridden one of these bikes, a typical journey. How, you know, we know, of course, what we know the vague outlines of what motivates people to leave their various home countries. But to the actual nature of the journey, particularly in this case, is really interesting. How might one of the people riding this bike, abandoning it in the Tijuana Valley River, have even come upon it?
Well, many of these migrants came from southern Mexico, and you can trace a lot of the waves of migration, most of them, in fact, to specific economic events. One had to do with a provision in NAFTA that opened up the Mexican corn market to mass-produced American corn, and it devastated all of these small corn farmers in southern Mexico, and it created a wave of migration. So a lot of these people were coming from very rural backgrounds and arriving at the border metropolis totally unaware of what it would look like, what they would encounter there, what their next step was. But it turns out that there's an entire enterprise set up in these border towns ready to receive them and take advantage of them in many instances. One of the first people a migrant will meet is a recruiter for various coyote operations. And that person will charm them, cajole them, promise them destinations, and they quote unquote, sell them to the coyote. They're kind of a middleman, but they deliver a migrant who doesn't even know his way around the city like Tijuana to an organization. Many of the coyotes hang their names on techniques. So there would be the guy who's an expert at a rope ladder, the guy who's an expert at taking people in ponga boats around the sea fence. Once the migrants get with them, they negotiate a price. They are promised destinations in the United States.
And how big a price, by the way?
You know, it's very interesting. It's there's classes of ticket, for one. If you cross in the desert, when I was researching, the price was as high as $1,500. That's the low fare. This price with the bicycles was $4,500. I also covered an incident where
$4,500 to buy bicycle. I mean, if you think about, even, you know, upper middle class Americans would never be able to afford, you know, a comfortable, luxurious airplane ride from one country to the other at that price. I mean, that is like, that's a huge amount of money.
Well, the migrants see it as an investment in their careers, just right, as you have made investments in your career, and most people do.
Sure.
Communities will pool money, and a migrant will be able to pay back the community. And in some instances, the migrants will cross for free, and then once they're working, pay back the coyotes. They never pay in Mexico. They always pay once they're in the United States. There's a very defined transaction that once they cross, a family member will get the money to the coyote, and that's so that should their crossing be thwarted in some way, they are guaranteed return tickets. They're guaranteed other chances.
So the Border Patrol has, of course, made it its business to try to thwart migrants and coyotes transporting migrants. Are they aware of the fact that bicycles have been used on the border, and how have they dealt with it?
Oh yeah, they're very aware. In this instance, the Border Patrol actually picked up a large number of these bicycles. They stored them for some time and then donated them to a prison in San Diego. There was an outfit in the prison that refurbished these bicycles, and they donated them back into the community. They donated them to children. And so that these bikes made their way back into the United States. At one stage, Border Patrol began driving over the bicycles and slashing the tires. I actually have a bike that the tire was slashed once it was found by a Border Patrol. There's another instance happening right now in the Arizona desert where people are using bicycles. But, you know, the technique isn't always as important, or isn't as important as the underlying fundamentals. On the border, crossing, creativity is the name of the game. And there's a simple equation that defines the entire border crossing and border defense enterprise, and it has to do with prohibitions. In the United States, when we don't like something, we tend to legislate prohibitions. And you can think about the prohibitions on alcohol in the 1930s. All that did was make gangsters and producers of illegal alcohol very rich. Alcohol was still widely available in the United States. It's the same for illegal labor. When we prohibit illegal labor, we inject artificial value into that market. And perversely, the more money and resources we put into defending that prohibition, the more value we inject into that market. So all of our walls, all of our, all of the technology, it tends to add value, and it only incentivizes more creativity, more professionalism, and more efficiency on the part of the smugglers.
Right. And so this idea that Donald Trump has to simply solve all of the U.S.'s immigration issues by building a wall is not going to do very much, is it?
Well, we have 700 miles of walls in place right now, and you can take a look at what happens to them. There's a section down here on the east end of Tijuana. It's got more holes in it than a pair of hobo pants, and that wall was expensive, and it's virtually new. As soon as defenses go up, people figure out how to go under them, over them, and in many cases, through them.
Let's go back to the issue of the bicycles. These 7,000 bicycles that formed the basis of this borderland empire that you write about, where did they come from? Are they all of Mexican origin? Do the bikes ever make multiple crossings, or are they sort of one-way tickets? Explain to us sort of the origins of the bicycles themselves.
Well, that was a huge question for me. I thought, is this a trend? Are people throughout Tijuana just deciding to cross on bicycle and grabbing any bike they could? If I'd looked closer at the bicycles that were abandoned there in the valley, I would have seen immediately stickers of registration in cities across the United States, stickers from the shops that they were sold from, stickers of that suggested they'd been sold at police auction. And it wasn't until I was well into it that I learned that the coyotes were going to police auctions across the Southwest, from Houston to Los Angeles. They were buying bicycles in lots. They were taking them across the border, designated as donations to charities in Mexico, and then they were putting migrants on top of them and sending them back across. In some instances, they were actually teaching migrants how to ride a bicycle before the crossing actually happened.
Oh, wow. So it involved a lesson in bike riding. I'm wondering, you know, how these sort of abandoned bicycles tell the stories of the migrants for you, because there've been, you know, art exhibits on the debris left behind by migrants that tell these, you know, searing and in some cases heartbreaking stories of the sacrifices people make. What do you see as a story being told by the abandoned bicycles?
Well, the bike has characteristics that are unlike almost any other machine. They find a place in people's hearts because it's your first experience of motion without any part of your body on the ground is your first freedom of movement, and opens up new parts of your of the world to you as a child. And so when I started asking questions about the bicycle, even though they had been involved in these illegal activities, people thought it was funny. They thought it was funny that the humble bicycle was defeating the massive border complex. And they'd slap their legs and they'd tell stories, and that affection for a bicycle opened up a window for these stories that I don't think any other technique for crossing or any other object could have had.
And how did you, tell us a little bit also about how you found this story, particularly of El Indio, not how you found the bicycles, but the person who was behind this lucrative empire, this borderland empire, as you call it. How deep did you have to go in to some of these networks? And I imagine that it might have also been a fairly risky prospect for you to do the research.
Well, as I mentioned, I had to talk to each person that handed the bicycle one to the next. As that was the only way to figure out how the bicycles were moving.
And how many bicycles did you trace?
I probably saw maybe a few thousand, but the coyotes claimed that they had crossed 7,000 people in a two-year period. And it's it's pretty small area. It's 5 miles of our 2,000-mile border that they were doing this. One of the difficulties of tracking the bikes is that they tended to move on just as soon as they hit the dirt. You know, people, looky-loos would be coming, people who had an affection for a bike. Everybody saw a bike that they wanted. But estimating how many bikes I saw and talking to the people who collected them in the valley, because each little family farm or ranch or the county park or the state park, they would all collect bicycles, and they all had estimations. And it seemed that I definitely know there were thousands, and it seems that the 7,000 number is accurate.
So you went and you traced bikes individually, person to person, and eventually you uncovered this sort of enterprise that was taking place. Tell us a little bit about the nature of the enterprise as well. How many people were in on it? Did it have the hallmarks of a traditional business? Were Border Patrol folks involved, you know, or have any knowledge of it? You know, if you can give us some of the sense of this story.
Well, you know, this is not an academic book. It's not even a political book. It's a story about people and what motivated them to cross and how they did it. The central figure was a young man who was nicknamed El Indio, and he grew up in a tiny little village in Oaxaca. His older brothers and older sisters immigrated to the United States when he was quite young. At one point, his parents told him, "Hey, listen, we're going to go to the United States and be with your brothers and sisters, and you're going to stay here with your grandfather, and the trade-off is you get to go to middle school here in Mexico." The plan was, if they were successful, they'd send for him. If not, they would just return. But it turned out that they lost contact, and the grandfather died. And once the young man was done with school, he had to make a decision. Do I stay here and try and eke out a living, or do I go to the border and try and establish some kind of contact with my family? He ended up doing that. And as I mentioned before, when a migrant comes to the border, they often have no idea what they're going to encounter there. A lot of times they arrive at the main bus terminal because the bus networks in Mexico are extensive. From there, they'll walk along the fence line. They'll end up in the river. People wander from the mountains to the oceans along the fence line looking for an opportunity. This character, El Indio, he was one of the rare migrants who took a moment to see that there was a business being made in getting people across the border. Not only he wasn't looking so much at making a living in the United States anymore. Once he saw that, he thought, hey, I can make enough to get by here on the border until I figure out a way to be with my family again. And he became a recruiter, that figure that I mentioned, and he would find migrants at the bus station and in the line or along the fence line, and he would recruit them. He'd pass them along to a coyote. And that way he learned the business. But he was a very observant character. There were stories about him that almost painted him as a Robin Hood type figure. And at one point, he just on a whim decided to cross into the United States on a bicycle because he thought it was possible. Wandering along the fence line, he observed every little nook and cranny, and he thought he saw a way. He did that a couple of times, and to his surprise, it was quite successful. He did it with a group of friends. They were successful, and that's when he realized that he could build a business out of this. He had no idea how successful it would become, but it just caught fire.
And our audience can pick up a copy of your book to find out what happened to him and this business. I want to thank you so much, Kimball Taylor, for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
My guest, Kimball Taylor, is the author of the book, The Coyote's Bicycle, The Untold Story of 7,000 Bicycles and a Borderland Empire. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/RU with Sonali.